You're listening to episode 14 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and yeah, this is episode 14 all of a sudden. I know, the previous episode was 15, but I kind of got confused thinking that 15 came after 13, and well, admittedly, I wasn't wrong. It does come after 13, just not immediately after 13. So I decided to just mix it up a little bit. Did 15 when I did 15, now I'm doing 14. Next episode will be back into the more traditional linear model of numbers, and we'll be going to 16, and then 17, and then 18, 19, and then 20, and of course 20 is the end of the season, so that's always an exciting time. For this episode, it is episode 14, and in this episode we will talk about Hiawatha web server again. Got some new information about that straight from the source. We'll be talking about QEMU, or Kimu, or KMU, however you say that, and probably some other stuff as well, but let's just get started and see what happens. Okay, so first I did want to cover feedback, listener feedback, because, well, that's what we always do, we do that first. But specifically, I got some really, really cool feedback, and I ought to just start with it, but I'm not going to. I'm going to make you wait for it. First, I'm going to give you the feedback. I mean, this is interesting feedback, too, but it's just not as big of a topic as the other one. From Doug, the Python person who I spoke of last week. And this time, he spoke to me via email as well as IRC, actually, and was just kind of reiterating that Python is a great thing to learn, and that it's a lot of fun to do GUI development and game development and stuff like that, and specifically that he has written an application in WXPython, but that he felt, and he likes the framework, but that he felt there was a learning curve to it. Now, presumably there's a learning curve to any Python GUI framework, so really hearing that doesn't discourage me at all. I don't think he meant it to discourage me, so it doesn't. But it does kind of reinforce almost my leaning of maybe I will just go the PyQt method for the little project or projects that I end up doing in with Python and a GUI. And I have used PyQt before. I used it in a SMPTE timecode calculator. Really basic little application. It's actually available from slackermedia.info/downloads. You can find it there. You need to have PyQt installed, and PyQt itself, of course, depends upon SIP, S-I-P, both from riverbankcomputing.co.uk, I think it is. I'll link to it anyway, but your package manager would surely have that in available anyway. And if you're on Slackware, then you can go to slackermedia.info/slackbuilds, and I've got build scripts, I think, or maybe they're just actual Slack packages, Slackware packages, pre-built, posted there. So very easy to get this stuff, and of course the advantage there as well is also that you can get it for Windows and the other platform, and then that I don't mention, and you can install it and run the Python GUI application on those platforms as well, which is quite nice. I'm sure there's probably some fancy way of packaging the applications with all that stuff bundled inside of your download and crazy things like that. I'm not interested really in that level of service to other platforms, so if they have to go out and download PyQt and SIP themselves, then they can. Point is, it is very, very portable. It doesn't require any modification of the code really to be able to run on the other platforms that I need it to run on, so it's kind of nice. And I have tested that. I've taken my little SMPTE calculator and run it on other platforms, and it's worked seamlessly, and it's really, really nice. So PyQt is probably the way I will go for my GUI exploration, because I've already used it once in a Python application and once in a very, very rudimentary C++ application, both times. No, once actually I did it just with raw text editor. I was going to say both times I used Qt Creator, but actually for the Python one I just did it all in a text editor. Got a lot of help from Rowan Golfer and a couple of other guys in OpenMolar on that, so that was great. And it's great that the Python people that I've met so far have been very much, I would say, let's just say, like, I would compare them to, you know, the Linux users that I know, meaning that they're very eager to share knowledge, and they're almost insistent upon sharing that knowledge. They're very, very, I would say evangelical, although I kind of have a negative connotation for that term, so maybe I won't say evangelical, but they definitely make it known that, yes, they are there to help, and that one should not be afraid to ask for help. And that's a great thing. That's a great quality to have, or a great trait for a language to have, you know, a really, really supportive and eager to help user base. That's the kind of stuff that I like. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. This summer I anticipate doing quite a bit of Python stuff, and if I figure anything important out, I'll be sure to pass it on to you, my dear listeners. Okay, next feedback, listener feedback, is, I guess, from Hugo, a guy named Hugo. Hugo was, emailed me. He listened to the show, episode 15, the one before 14, naturally, and said that that I got it wrong about Hiawatha, and that I said that I was not able to figure out how to specify an error page per virtual host. And then I even said that I thought Hiawatha must have been generating the error page with PHP. I was totally wrong. Not only can you specify an error page per virtual host, but Hiawatha does not need PHP for anything. So I was just... I shouldn't have said that offhand about PHP, because I didn't verify it. It was a guess, and I shouldn't have really said that. So I was wrong to have implied that at all. But the error handler is a little bit more complex. It's nothing, apparently, that I couldn't have found by reading the documentation, although I will say that I did do a search on the internet and was not really able to find the answer that I needed. But I guess I should have just gone straight to the source, to Hiawatha, webserver.org, and you know, looked at the documentation and looked around there first. So that was really poor research on my part, and I'm glad that this fellow Hugo decided to email me and kind of clarify things. So it turns out that Hugo, the guy who emailed me, is Hugo, I'm going to butcher his last name, Lysink, maybe, or Lysink, or Lysink, whatever his last name pronunciation is, he's the guy who wrote Hiawatha. So it was really, really cool to get an email from him. I was really excited to see that the author of Hiawatha Web Server, which, again, if I didn't make it clear in the last episode, it's been treating us really, really well. It is literally the web server from which you downloaded this episode. That's what's running GNU World Order, and it's running Slacker Media, and it's running a couple of other sites as well. And it's not a big, beefy server that it's running on. It's a fairly modest server with not a whole lot of RAM. And granted, the pages that we are serving are very, very simple. They don't use PHP or Ruby or Python or any of the fancy scripting things that you could possibly think of on a web page. They're all flat files. So they're just personal sites. They're not getting hit by a whole bunch of people, as far as I know. But they're still, you know, it's still running really well. And we use the server for other stuff, and it never feels like, oh, we should get a separate account for this web server, and we should use this server for our day-to-day work. It doesn't feel like it's getting in the way at all. So I've been really pleased with Hiawatha. The only problem I did have with it was this error handler, and here's how that played out. So after I got the email, I went back into my Hiawatha.conf file and tried to configure the error handler thing again, because I knew how to do it in theory. The virtual host configuration is very, very simple. It's just as simple in the Hiawatha conf as it is in the Nginx conf, as it is in the THTTPD conf. Actually, I can't even remember if the THTTPD conf requires you to make an entry in the configuration for a virtual host. I can't remember off the top of my head. But anyway, it's very, very simple. It's you go into the configuration file, you type in virtual host, curly bracket, host name equals, and then whatever you want the host name to be, website root, and then whatever you want the website root folder to be, start file equals, you know, index.html or whatever you want that to be. If you want the error handlers, you do this. You do error handler equals, for instance, 404 colon slash, I don't know, errors slash error 404.html, or wherever the location of that page that you want to be displayed upon a 404 error is located. So I did that, and that worked. The 404 colon slash worked. But that had always worked for me. So what I was really after, and I guess failed to specify were the other pages, like the 403, the 400, the 401, the 500, and so on. The problem is really just with one line. So I would have done fine if I'd stuck to, for instance, 401, 403, 404, 501, and 503. It was the 400 error that it could not process. Hiawatha doesn't provide an error handler for 400 or something like that. Point is, 400 is the thing that was kicking it, that was causing the bug in my configuration file. So when I was troubleshooting this, I would go sort of in that order. I would do the 404, that would work, and then I would paste in my whole block of 400, 403, 404, 401, and 500, and then restart Hiawatha, and sure enough, it would fail. So what I did not do was try each error handler individually. For instance, insert a 400 error code, restart Hiawatha. Does it work? Yes. No. If not, then that's the bug. If yes, proceed to 403, and so on. Turns out 400 didn't work. I would have found it out pretty quickly if I went in order, but I just didn't do that troubleshooting step. Oops. So what Hugo wrote back, I wrote him and kind of pasted in the code and asked him what I was doing wrong. And he said that, as is described in the manual page, error handlers are available from HTTP error 401, 403, 404, 501, and 503. So literally all I had to do was remove the error 400 line and restart Hiawatha, and it totally worked. So that was very enlightening, but further enlightening, because I mean, that I could have figured out eventually on my own, I guess. But what was a really good point, and that I hadn't really thought of, was that he says that his advice is to only use an error handler if it really adds something. 404, okay, that's understandable. That's a pretty common error. 403, do you have files within your website that are not readable by your web server? And then I was thinking, you know, if you do have files in your web server that are not readable, what are they doing there? 401, do you really want a custom page for incorrect HTTP authentication failures? Do you even use HTTP authentication? Of course I don't. 500, do you really expect many internal errors? And so on. So he makes a really good point. He says that unused error handlers don't do any harm, but specifying one without needing it does seem pointless. So I thought that was a really great point, something that I had not thought of. It's probably a really good thing to kind of keep in mind, not only for security issues, but just kind of for troubleshooting and kind of like potential for things to go wrong. And indeed, if I had kept my configuration file simple and not defined error codes that I really didn't expect anyone to ever use, then it wouldn't have gone wrong, and I would have never noticed anything at all, and wouldn't have had a problem. So that's a really good point, especially when getting up and running when you're just starting out on a certain application. You know, you go into the configuration file and you make all these changes because it's like a candy store. There's all these comments, and they're offering all these great things to you. And then you start the application, and it doesn't work. That's silly. It's better to try to run it as plain vanilla as possible, I would think. You know, this is the configuration file that came with it. I'm going to make the necessary changes that they tell me I must make. Then I'm going to test it. And then if it works, I'll go in and maybe make some more changes. And then if it fails, then I know why it failed. And of course, it is true, as always, to make one or two changes at a time, so that when you know you're not pasting in big blocks of code or going through and customizing it, so that when it does fail, you really don't know where it failed. All you know is that, well, now I've made a bunch of changes and something broke it, and then you have to go back through and, you know, comment stuff out. So just go in, make a couple of changes, restart, see if it works, make more changes, restart, see if it works, and so on. So I think I rushed in a little bit where I wasn't supposed to rush in. And I guess now I know better, and I'm glad that I had that conversation with Hugo, and I'm really glad that he gave me the feedback and bothered listening to the show at all. So that was really cool. So thank you, Hugo, if you are listening to this episode. I appreciate it. And if you're not, that's okay, too. So, yeah, that's about all the feedback I've gotten so far. Of course, it is only a week since the previous episode, so I'm doing that because I needed to get back on the schedule since I was late last episode. We're doing an episode this week just to get back on the correct schedule. In my mind, in my own secret mind, I do GNU World Order on weeks that Dev Random does not do an episode. Or is it Kernel Panic? I think it's Kernel Panic, actually. Yeah, I do it opposite the weeks that Kernel Panic does their episodes. Originally, that was because I was on Kernel Panic, and now I haven't been on Kernel Panic in such a long time that I guess I'm not on Kernel Panic. But nevertheless, I'm trying to be opposite of Kernel Panic. So now I should be back on that schedule, and so are you. Ah, Q-Emu, or Kimu, or Kimu. I don't know how you say it, but it's a great application. I've talked about it before on this show. I've done a lot of intros on it over the course of this show. I mean, I think literally from season one, possibly, I've done talks about Q-Emu. It was, I guess, the first emulator I knew about at all, and it just so happens that it's kind of a popular Linux, Unix-y type of emulator. It's not fancy and pretty like VirtualBox or that other one, but it's a really solid one. It's really, really nice. It's changed a lot in my time with it, and happily I have kind of kept notes on it from the very beginning. I don't really remember exactly when I started playing around with it. It wasn't on Linux. It was on some other platform. So I've been with it for a while, and I'm probably shamefully slow on the pickup in terms of getting the hang of it, but it's literally always served my needs. I've never felt like it was inadequate for anything that I was doing. An important qualifier here is that I'm not doing enterprise level virtualization. I'm not even doing for fun level virtualization. I'm doing hobbyist virtualization. The typical thing for me with QEMU or whatever is that I will create a virtual machine just because I'm curious about some distribution. What's its installer like? Or once it's installed, what are their defaults like? It's really basic, kind of out of curiosity, because I have a spare hour to spend on doing whatever, I'll fire up a virtual machine and play around with something in the virtual environment. Very rarely do I do any kind of serious work in that virtual environment. I've also used it for things like I'm writing an article, I need to get a screenshot of some stock install of this distribution, and so I will take a screenshot of it. Or I will install Slackware on a virtual machine because I need a pristine install of Slackware so that I can test this Slack build. That's the kind of usage I have for QEMU. It's got nothing to do with quote-unquote virtualization like a lot of people talk about virtualization. So that's the level I'm at. That being said, I've done some pretty fun things with QEMU lately, and I kind of think it might be worth talking about a little bit, because some of them are not super simple, I guess. They've been a little bit, I don't know if I want to say advanced or anything like that, but I feel like it's been kind of, I don't know, interesting. I mean, I think I've been doing some interesting things with it. So I'm going to talk about some of the things that I've been doing. The two spoilers, so that you know what to expect or whether you want to fast forward through this, are I will be talking a little bit about KVM, but I also want to talk about just running it in a terminal, meaning rather than telling your server or the virtual server that you're creating with QEMU, rather than telling it that it has a video output, you're telling it that it's got a very basic video output, and you're sending all of that output to an incurses interface within your terminal. Kind of neat. I'll talk to you about networking to your virtual machine as well. So, the backstory of all this is that I was preparing for my talk at Northeast Linux Fest, and I realized that in order to demonstrate how to set up a Git server, which, by the way, is marvelously easy, but in order to demonstrate that really well, I needed to have a server. I didn't know if I could count on internet access at this event. I wasn't really sure I wanted to rely on the internet access that I may or may not have during a talk. Doing real-time stuff during a talk is hard enough, but relying on a connection to the internet during a talk is even worse. So I figured if I could at least just create a local instance of a server, I could SSH into that, show the audience how to create their little Git repository there, and then drop back to my local machine and demonstrate how to talk to that server. I thought that would be a really good way to sort of have a presentation be less likely to fail. So that's why I started exploring all of these different options, and one of the things that kind of made me nervous was I was going to have my laptop plugged into a projector, and then I'm going to fire up another screen, a virtual screen, for my little virtual server that I didn't even really need a screen for. I just didn't want there to be the potential of messing up my, you know, my presentation, which, I mean, my presentation is an open terminal window, but still, I didn't want there to be any kind of video display issues. So I wanted a way to get the server just kind of running in text mode, essentially. And that's what I'm going to talk about right now. First of all, QEMU, as you probably know, emulates the architecture. So it's a CPU emulator. Now, it can only emulate the environment so much, obviously, and that's where KVM comes in. So if you've got a KVM-capable CPU, which you can find out by doing an egrep space single quote caret flags dot asterisk paren VMX pipe SVM, close paren, close quote, space, slash, proc, slash, CPU info. That block of code, that little command, is available at straightedgelinux.com/blog/how-to/qemu.html, which this page that I'm kind of working off for this podcast is a document that I've maintained pretty much since I've been using QEMU, and I've basically kept it up to date ever since then. So it's got a lot of great info in it, so if you like what I'm talking about here and want show notes, that's where you're going to want to go, and I will include a link to it in the show notes of newworldorder.info. So anyway, you can check your CPU to see if you've got KVM capabilities with that command. If you get nothing back, you cannot use KVM, but you could still use QEMU, so don't worry. It just won't be as fast and capable of performing quickly for you, but it can still work for you, and especially if you're just going after a basic server setup like I am. So if you do have KVM capabilities, then all you need to do is, with root privileges, obviously do a mod probe, KVM-intel, or whatever it is for AMD. You might have to look that up, because I haven't been doing that on AMD lately, so I have done it on AMD, but not lately. So mod probe KVM-intel, and that provides you all the KVM features that you would want. If you don't have that, that's okay. Just skip that step. It's not a big deal. If QEMU is not installed yet, of course you would install it with your package manager, and then you would want to create yourself a fake hard drive. This is easy. QEMU-img, like QEMU image, QEMU-img space create space dash F as in format space qcow2 space sandbox dot qcow2 space 8g. That would create a disk image, a QEMU image, with the format of qcow2. That's kind of the default format. There are others. I know nothing about them. And then the name of the file that it's creating, sandbox.qcow2. Yes, your hard drive will just be a little file on your real hard drive. And then space 8G for 8 gigs, or 16G for 16 gigs, however big you want that hard drive to be. As I understand it, this creates a sparse image, so it's actually not 16 gigabytes yet, or 8 gigabytes, whatever you've set it for. It can expand up to that large. That's what I understand. I don't really know much about that either. Okay, so the basic command for QEMU, and this is just the basic one, just to show you, yes, it works, would be QEMU-system-i386, because I am going to emulate a 32-bit system. If you wanted QEMU-system-x86_64, then that's what you would use. You could use QEMU-system-arm if you wanted that, or -PPC or -PPC64. There's a whole host of the CPU architectures that it can emulate. Just look in /usr/bin and kind of look around for the QEMU-system-asterisk and look at what your options are. We'll do an i386 at this point, and then we could do a space dash CPU space question mark and hit return, and it will tell us all the different CPUs that within that architecture that it can emulate. You can also leave that off and just let it decide automatically what it wants to emulate. I think by default it just does the QEMU CPU, which is just, I guess, a generic 32-bit or x86 architecture chip. But you can do things like Core Duo or Athlon, whatever. So, -CD-ROM /dev/CD-ROM. So your CD-ROM is actually the virtual host, the virtual machine's CD-ROM. -boot delta. It's the the drive that it's going to boot off of, which in this case is the CD-ROM. If you want it to boot off of a hard drive, it would be C-boot C. And then -drive, this is the drive that it's going to look at if you need to install something. File equals /sandbox.qcow2. So that's the file that we just made. So that command would get a very basic QEMU image launched for, as long as you've got an ISO in your, a live CD in your CD drive, or an install CD or whatever. That'll do it. So that, there's your proof of concept. That's how it works. It's really, really simple. It's not difficult to start up a virtual machine at all. It's literally that simple. You make a QEMU image, and then you start QEMU and point it at whatever location you want it to boot from. Now, you can also just use an ISO image. There's no need to burn it to a disk. I frequently get disks with magazines, so I'm frequently using a physical CD-ROM or a DVD, but you can just as easily download an ISO from the internet and use that, and that would be very similar. It'd just be QEMU-system-i386 /CPU, QEMU32, or whatever you want, -CD-ROM /downloads/ Slackware 14 .iso -boot delta again -drive file equals /sandbox.qemu or .qcow2. Again, it's just kind of pointing it to either a CD or an ISO image, telling it to boot from what we're calling D delta, the D drive, I guess, and that knows to boot from that CD ROM image or disk or whatever. Very, very simple. There are other options. You could do a -m, lowercase m as in memory, and tell it how much RAM you want to assign to that QEMU image. But the options I'm really interested in, and that I'm finally going to talk about, are the -curses, and to a lesser extent, the -no graphic options. I'm really only mentioning the no graphic option because it's a good way to kind of understand what QEMU usually does and what it doesn't do when you pass the -curses flag. So when you do the plain QEMU-system-architecture and then the CD-ROM and all that stuff, you know, the normal commands that we've just gone over, when you do that, you hit return, a new window pops open, and that's driven by SDL, the graphic library SDL, and it's displaying all of the it's an emulated monitor, right? You see exactly what you would see if you were booting that ISO or that CD-ROM, whatever, off of a physical machine. And that works. But, I mean, if you think about what you get when you are booting into FreeBSD or Slackware or even Salix or DragonflyBSD, any of those kinds of distributions where the init tab does not specify, yes, let's launch an X11 graphic server, then you don't have to, you're kind of emulating a whole monitor where that's really, it seems a little bit excessive, right? So the -no graphic flag obliterates the VGA card from your virtual machine. You can just picture, you know, a headless server without a graphics card at all. Didn't come with a graphics card. You plug into the serial port, you get the output. That's what no graphic does. So if you were to launch a session of QEMU with all the same arguments that we've just had, but specifying -no graphic, you would go into a QEMU monitor mode, and in theory get all of the serial output, just like you were monitoring a serial port of a headless server. I've not actually done that. I've not tried that. I've got no need to do that. But it's something that apparently that you do with -no graphic. The point is that those are the two extremes. You've got the normal QEMU action of launching an SDL window so that you can see pretty graphics in your emulated monitor versus, hey, there's no VGA card in your server at all. Well, there's also a -curses. Now, -curses is a nice little middle ground between those two, and it uses incurses as its graphics server, essentially. Now, that sounds like a horrible idea if you've ever seen incurses. It just doesn't do graphics, right? It's huge blocky pixels of color. There are no graphics there. Well, that's kind of true for this as well. You can't fire up QEMU with the -curses and expect there to be even a low res representation, at least that I've seen so far in any of the terminal emulators I've used, of graphics. But if you're booting into something like Slackware or FreeBSD or DragonflyBSD or something like that, where there is no X server being launched at all, there's never a graphic on screen through the entire installation or post-installation reboot process, then incurses can handle that just fine. So type in your little QEMU QEMU commands, and instead of no graphic, you put dash curses. Your terminal, whatever terminal you're in, or your virtual console, whatever, gets taken over. It tells you that it's switching over to 640 by 480 graphics mode, and then it starts giving you all the usual output that you would be used to when you're booting into any of those distributions. It's really, really cool. And you can go through the whole installation process, install the thing onto your little virtual QCOW2 drive, and reboot, and never need a virtualized monitor at all. You'll never have to open a new window for QEMU, meaning that you're not driving any kind of serious, you know, you're not doing any serious graphic emulation. I mean, you are in curses, but in terms of the load on your system and what your video drivers on your actual computer think they need to do, it's a lot simpler. It's also just a lot neater for me when you're doing this. I just kind of like the idea of being able to have one terminal or one virtual console launched, or one session of screen, whatever you're doing for your multi screens in a terminal environment, or a shell environment, I should say. You don't ever have to leave that. You're never launching another window. It all stays nice and tidy within one little terminal session. So it's really, really slick, and it's one of those really simple ways to get a test server up and running within no time. So what I did was I did a Salix install, because I think, as I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, I'd been playing around with Salix as a lightweight and sort of quick and dirty install of Slackware, and then I just rip out all the Salix stuff, put in all the Slackware parts, and I'm up and running, and it's all very quick and lightweight and doesn't require a huge download from anywhere. So I'd done that. I launched it within curses and had Salix running in this terminal session, and I realized that I really needed to be able to talk to this thing through a couple of different ports. I'd never really done any kind of real serious networking with QEMU before, so I looked into how to do that. Now, there's a danger here to get very, very confused, because you'll read online about the internal IP of your virtual machine, which is set to, I think, 10.10.2.15 or 10.0.2.15 or something like that, and then there's QEMU itself, which creates a firewall around that virtual machine at 10.0.2.2, I think. So you've kind of got this IP that your computer could, I think, be aware of at 10.0.2.2, and then you've got the virtual machine within that network at 10.0.2.15, and you might start to try to figure out how to get from one to the other, and that's the wrong path to go down. That little network exists, and you can have virtual machines talking to one another, which is kind of neat, but it's not for your host machine. For your host machine to be able to talk to the virtual machines, I mean, there are a couple of different ways to do it, but I'm telling you the way that I found was easiest and quickest, and I don't know, simplest, is to do a redirect of local ports to the ports that your virtual machine can recognize. In other words, you would do a QEMU-system-i386 /cursors/cdrom/salix.iso/boot/delta/drive/file=\sandbox.qcow2. That's a pretty complete command that normally would launch a perfectly valid session of this Salix ISO. But before we hit return, we're going to add a couple of new arguments. One is a dash net, that is dash N-E-T, like network, space N-I-C, like network interface card. So now we've just created a network interface card on the virtual machine. We do another dash net, space user, meaning that the virtual machine now has permission to actually utilize that network interface card. And then we do another space dash reader, R-E-D-I-R, as in redirect, TCP:/22122::22. So I'll say that again. It's TCP, meaning obviously the protocol that we're redirecting, right? :/22122. That is going to be our localhost port, and then :/22. So we're redirecting all TCP traffic on localhost port 22.1.22 to the virtual machine's port 22. I think you kind of see where I'm going with this, probably. If you hit return now, QEMU will launch this session. You could install Salix. You could reboot. You would make sure that on Salix, SSH server is running, because that was a mistake that I made for about 4 hours while I was banging my head against this process. Make sure that the server on your virtual machine, the SSH server on your virtual machine is running. And then on your local machine, on the host machine, you could open a terminal and do an SSH-P for port 22122. Of course, that's arbitrary. I just made 22122 up. You could make it any big port number that you want, but that's what we use for QEMU, and that's what I'm using now. So SSH space dash P as in port 22122 space CLATU at localhost. It feels kind of weird because you're SSHing to localhost, and you never do that, right? But you're SSHing to the localhost at port 22122, which QEMU knows is being redirected to the virtual machine's port 22. So now you will find yourself sitting at a prompt, well, a password prompt probably, for your virtual machine inside of your local host. It's pretty slick. Now you can, of course, redirect other ports as well. If you wanted to fire up a sample web server and treat it like it's, well, a web server on the internet, you could redirect all TCP traffic from, you know, to localhost port, I don't know, 22188. Or 12128, whatever you want, :80. So now, of course, if you point a web browser at localhost :22188, or whatever you assigned it, it would then be redirected to the virtual machine's port 80. And suddenly you've got a web server running in a terminal window that you can access via your web browser. So it's really, really cool. It's a lot of fun. There's really, I guess, kind of no excuse to not get into playing around with virtual servers at this point. I mean, it's just so simple. You don't even need a fancy computer. I mean, I've done these little virtual servers on all kinds of machines at this point. And yeah, some of them are very slow. But once it's up and running, it's not really that bad as long as you just want a destination to knock on some ports. That sets it up really quickly. And literally you don't even have to have a graphics server launched at this point to successfully emulate the machine. So it can be very, very lightweight. And if you pick and choose which distribution you emulate, some of them are just really, really lightweight, easygoing on your system. You can emulate it on all kinds of different machines. So very, very easy, very, very fun. You should definitely try it out. Again, you can read all of this stuff, everything that I've figured out so far about QEMU in general, including the KVM stuff, and the networking stuff, and the incurses stuff. You can read all about that at straightedgelinux.com/blog/how-to/QEMU.html. Okay, that music means it's time for a cup of coffee, so go get yourself one. I'm gonna go get myself one, and then we'll reconvene and finish up the show. Couple of things came to me while I was having a cup of coffee. You know how it is, you're sitting around enjoying your coffee, thoughts go through your head. I realized I ought to tell you about a little trick, not really a trick, but I mean something that I've found for QEMU that is quite nice. Well, first of all, I should mention again KVM. KVM will drastically, dramatically improve the performance of your virtual machine on Linux. Use it if you've got it, really. I don't have it on my laptop, so I don't use it on my laptop, and I feel the impact. But obviously for that reason, I don't do a lot of virtualization or work in a virtual machine on my laptop. I do QEMU on my laptop, but I not for large tasks. So if you're using QEMU as you would, like, VirtualBox or any other kind of, like, hey, here's a virtual machine, please use it and to do real work within. If you're doing that, you might want to make a RAM disk for it. So RAM disks, Cobra 2 really got me started on RAM disks. He kept talking about them, never really understood what he was talking about, had never used one before. Then I get this great computer at work, and it's got literally, I think it's got 24 gigabytes of RAM on it. I'm never touching near that much, so I figured, okay, it's time to investigate a little bit more about this thing called a RAM disk. It's embarrassingly easy, and if you've got this spare RAM for it, you might as well do it, because then you can create this RAM disk and put your QCOW image on the RAM disk. And so it's basically running, you know, it's as if though your virtual machine has like an SSD drive or something. I mean, it can speed things up drastically. And of course, this has nothing to do with KVM. So if you don't have KVM, you can, and you have a lot of RAM, then you can, or a little bit of RAM, if you have enough RAM to make a sizable little temporary disk out of that, out of a chunk of RAM, then you could create your QCOW 2 hard drive in a RAM disk. That'd be a bad idea if you want it to stick around on a long-term basis. But if you're just messing around with it and you want things to be a little bit snappier, then try making a RAM disk. If you don't know how to make a RAM disk, it's not hard at all. It's embarrassingly easy, actually. It's literally one command. It is mount, space dash T for type, tempfs, space dash O, space size equals 4G, or you know, whatever size disk you want to create, space RAM disk space slash MNT slash zip, or wherever you want to mount the RAM disk to. It's that easy. It works marvelously. I do that, and then I do my QCOW or my QEMU dash IMG command and save my QCOW hard drive to the RAM disk. So you're just saving it straight to your RAM, and it's gonna be really, really fast. It could literally change whether you decide to use a virtual machine or not. Whether it's that common to have that much RAM sitting around for an entire install of Linux is, yeah, I admit, could be true, could be not. But then again, think of all those small, tiny little Linux distributions out there. So it could be something to look into. Now, the other thing that kind of occurred to me while I was sipping my hot coffee was the idea of selling software. And I know you're thinking, how did we get from QEMU to the idea of selling software? Well, obviously I've been thinking a little bit about the idea of making money with free software, because that was Mad Dog's talk at Northeast Linux Fest. I mentioned that in the previous episode, and it's just something that comes up, you know, a fair amount. If you work in the computer industry, you see people purchasing all this software, and you think, wow, I can do all of that stuff for free. Why don't they get that? Recently, that very thing came up because there was a web design class being offered. And to the credit of the teacher of this web design class, he's teaching a lot of, like, real coding. And in fact, he requested me to install gedit on the machines that are not running Linux, but he wanted gedit on there so that people could experience a featureful, full text editor, you know, a serious text editor, rather than the default one that came with this platform, this non-Linux platform, or the for-pay text editors that kind of people latch on to and rave about with all these fancy features that a couple of people really do use and most people don't, and anyway, they are all available in free text editors anyway. So that was cool. But the interesting thing that kind of came up during this was this for-pay application that magically installs an Apache, MySQL, and PHP stack on these other platforms. So it's not a LAMP stack, it's some other letter, and then AMP stack. And I looked into these things, and they even do actually have one for Linux. It's like this weird sort of, this install on Linux that installs everything into slash opt, I guess, and you've got this kind of self-contained server environment within your Linux machine. And I just looked at this and I just thought, why would anyone do that? I mean, even on this other platform that's not Linux that we are using here at this school, there are ways to get a server up and running on, you know, locally. So why would you pay money for this installer that's going to really do next to nothing other than give you a pretty icon on your desktop? And you're paying for it. You're paying for this package, you know, you're paying for something that has just been, it's just a repackaging of a bunch of free software. And I don't see that as being evil or necessarily deceitful. I don't know that anyone is claiming that this is a lot of work, but you're definitely paying for a service, right? Because obviously it's very, very clear to everyone or to anyone who knows anything about this stuff that you can fire up a web server or a couple of web servers on your own machine, whether you do it just straight with a locally running web server, I mean, and then you just point everything to localhost 80, or maybe even if you want the full server experience, you could clearly, as I've just demonstrated, fire up QEMU and run a very lightweight server, sort of literally, or at least figuratively literally, in a terminal window, you know? I mean, it can be that simple, and it can be so small, and it can be so free, and it doesn't require a fancy computer. It's just something that you can do with two commands, and you're good. You've got a server that you can interact with on lots and lots of different levels. In fact, more levels and more realistically than you could on any of these repackaged things that I've seen. Because all they're doing is they're giving you an interface, a GUI interface, to click, yes, launch an Apache server, yes, launch a MySQL server, yes, turn on PHP. Silly things like that. They're not even giving you sort of the experience of, hey, you've got a server now, why don't you go in and turn on the web server, or why don't you go in and restart your web server. You know, all of these things that really as a web guru you would want to have at least some basic understanding of. And so they're repackaging all this stuff and they're selling it to people for a nominal fee. I mean, I think it was $50 or $49.99, something like that. Not unreasonable, I wouldn't say, but it was funny to someone who could totally see through the gimmick. You know, I could totally see what this was, a repackaging of very, very common, like so common it's sometimes installed by default on, you know, half a dozen Linux distributions. It's just that simple. And so I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, why didn't I think of that? You know, why didn't I think to repackage a bunch of free software and sell it for $50. Sell it to a school. To sell it to the web design department of some small town school. You could make money that way, and it's based on free software, and it's completely, like, I think it's legit, you know? I mean, it's like, it's a legitimate way that you're making certain people's lives easier. You're charging them for your time and your ideas and your design. But it's all based on free software. And I know some people have problems with that, because it's kind of like, well, if the Apache people and if the MySQL people and if the PHP people wanted to make money off of their products, then they would be repackaging it this way. But I don't see it as that. I see it as really kind of a resourceful sort of hack of a programmer somewhere, putting just enough wrapping around a free software project and putting it back out there and selling it. To their credit, and I think this is kind of why I don't think it's that bad, to their credit, they do offer a free version with fewer features or something like that. So you can still get free for free. But if you want the extra features, or if you just want to pay for software, I guess, which, you know, yeah, some places do, then you've got that option. So it was a really interesting kind of study in, here's a way to make money off of free software. And I don't know, I guess, at the end of the day, I'm ambivalent towards it, because I see what they're doing. I see that it's almost taking other people's work and capitalizing upon it, which seems weird. But at the same time, it's also fulfilling a need, something that people want to be able to do without necessarily opening up a manual, a 500-page manual, and read through it and figure out, here's how to install Linux, here's how to start a web server, here's a whole new world that you don't even understand right now. Here's what a computer is. Here's what a server is. You know, it's a lot of studying, and some people can't be bothered. So providing them a shortcut for a fee is not a horrible way to make money off of free software, I think. Now, whether or not that's the right answer for them is a whole other argument, I think, because I do feel that people who take that shortcut, who pay the $50 or whatever, they're kind of cheating themselves, right? Because when things go wrong, and when they screw up their web server because they don't understand what a root folder is in the web server, or they don't understand whatever, that's kind of a problem for them. But isn't it kind of the same principle as if they go out and buy Adobe Dreamweaver, or whatever Adobe is peddling these days for, you know, make really cool websites without any coding? I mean, aren't those kinds of people cheating themselves in the long run? Yeah, they kind of are. They really are. So, I don't know. It's all kind of a magical capitalistic ecosystem that truly, truly can be sustained with free software. Which, again, for a lot of people, that's just mind-blowing. And I'm not crazy about making money and the whole depending on money thing. Really not terribly fond of capitalism at all, to be honest. But if that's what's going on right now, and if you need to eat and pay rent, then teaching yourself free software, really getting to know it, can be an amazingly lucrative investment. Which, of course, brings me to the final point of this episode. From now on, I'll be charging you for new episodes of GNU World Order. No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't do that to you. GNU World Order is now and always will be free, so do not pay, actually, for GNU World Order. Well, unless you want to pay someone to make, you know, like, to download the episodes and burn it to a disc for you or something. I mean, again, it's kind of like that's what it's all about, right? I mean, you can make money in all kinds of weird ways, and it doesn't have to be about a product that you yourself created. It can be about the service. So rather than charging you for GNU World Order, I'm giving you permission to charge other people for GNU World Order. Go for it. Make some money. Okay, that's about all I had to talk about. I did want to mention someone had asked me in IRC where the archives for all of the old shows are located. Turns out they are all online. I failed to kind of advertise that, so I'm going to direct you to where they are so that you can find them easily. And they are on, of course, GNUWorldOrder.info. And if you look in the upper-ish left-hand corner of the webpage, you'll see an archive link. That seems pretty simple, but specifically people have been asking me about the old show notes. So if you go into whatever season you're looking for instance, let's go into season 7. And by the way, if you see that directory listing in the archive section, that's Hiawatha, by the way. XSLT style sheets is generating the slick look of that directory listing. I learned that from Hugo. So anyway, go into season 7. There's all the OGG files, and then there's OGG7.xml. That's the old feed. And then there's season7.html. That's the show notes. Those are all the show notes for this season. So that's in each season where available. I had all the old index.html files and the old feed files that like og.xml. I don't archive the speaks ones or the MP3, the old MP3s from the bad Apple days. Don't really bother with that. But the og files and the show notes themselves are just in whichever season they would belong in. So check that out if you're looking for old show notes of past seasons. And of course, this season itself, season 8, will be relegated to a folder in that archive once we're finished with the season, which is in, what, 5 more episodes? Okay, so that's it. Thank you for listening, as always, and I will talk to you next time for episode 16. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or slackermedia.info. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.